Okay. I wanted to begin with some points about Gideon that I did not get to last time. First, his name, what his name signifies, and then the way he's renamed. And I will have more to say about this when we get to, you know, how does Gideon kind of change through the narrative, these three chapters we have. Gideon means hacker, like one who beats or hacks or cuts. And remember, when you're first introduced to him, that's exactly what he's doing. He's on this threshing floor, but he's threshing out in the vineyard as opposed to out in the open, because these are people who are under assault and under persecution, so he's got to take care of the wheat in this hidden way. Later on, once he topples the statue to Baal by night, then he gets this nickname or new name, Jerubbaal, which one who contends against Baal, you know, one who's opposing or contending. And Lillian Klein will talk about how at various points in the narrative he's a hacker. We see this by chapter 8, where he really is hewing down his enemies. But we'll also see in various ways that he is a contender. And the first person that not only is there contending with Baal, overturning his statue, this idol to him, remember when he's first relating to the angel of God who's appeared to him and told him that he's had this mission, that does not go easily, does it? There do appear to be some contentions. Could you wet the fleece? Could you dry the fleece? Could you, you know, he needs a lot in order to be sure of himself and to be sure of what God is entrusting to him. And I talked about this last time, that Gideon's a wonderful illustration of somebody who has a hard time realizing for himself what God is doing. There are some commentators that they'll look at this episode and they'll say, this is just a man who doubts. But the patience that the angel shows to him, I think, indicates this isn't just sort of doubt or skepticism. I mean, contrast this episode to, let's say, Zechariah, when the angel Gabriel appears to Zechariah. And Zechariah tells him that his wife is going to be her son, you should name him John. How shall I know this, since I am a man who's advanced in years? And what kind of response does he get? I am one of the seven who stand before God, and you don't believe me? You're not going to be able to talk. And he goes, oh, right, right. He comes out completely mute and isn't able to talk again until John is born. Okay, so where there is skepticism, angels appear to be very patient. And I think you have to infer that what Gideon is not someone who's doubting what he hears in the sense of doubting God's power, but he's doubting what he hears in terms of him being an instrument for it, or doubting that he can carry this out, or that he's the means. In a way, you might think of him as being like Moses' own self-deprecation and the difficulty that he has realizing for himself what God will work through it. At a certain point, God says, enough, you're doing it, with Moses. But that Newman will use that as an example of how it is that whatever spiritual gifts that you have, the difficulty isn't so much that you believe in the divine or not. It's, do you believe in the divine concretely working in your life? You know, do you believe in the divine concretely working something miraculous in you? Or do you really just think of yourself as, no, I'm just going to be an ordinary person and hope God forgives me and I hope the expectations aren't too high? It's almost like the way that you'll have these very bright boys as students that they don't want to show you how intelligent they are, because then you'll have higher expectations of them. And, you know, that God has given you gifts that are real gifts that allow you to live a supernatural life. There are times in which you almost want to kind of gently push that away, because, of course, then the expectations are higher. And we'll talk more about these nicknames in a bit. I wanted to talk a little bit about these enemies, because, you know, some of these enemies we hear about in Judges, we don't necessarily hear about them again, or they've been Moabites and Ammonites. They're kind of recurrent enemies. They're sort of on the recurrent enemies list, if you like. But the Midianites make a kind of an impression for a number of reasons. Remember that the Midianites, this was the first group of people that Moses fled to. Remember, Jethro was a Midianite. Sometimes you'll see it Midian, sometimes you'll see it Madian. I don't know why it's one or the other, except I guess this goes back to where you don't have the vowels. You have to infer which vowels belong there. Remember, when you read Hebrew, it doesn't have vowels. You have to infer what vowels are there more often than not. So it could be Midian, could be Madian, but this is the first group. They're right in between where Egypt is and then where the Promised Land is. And one of the things, I made this little note to myself because I wanted to mention earlier, they've got this reputation for camels. You know, you might think of like everybody in the Middle East has camels. No. I mean, there are folks who have camels and they're pretty good at managing them. There are lots of folks who don't. The Hebrew soldiers are fighting these folks who are coming on camels. And they just find that really intimidating. They are not at ease with camels. So you have to kind of change that mindset. You just think, okay, this is desert. I've seen Lawrence of Arabia. Everybody seems to be going around on camels. No, not everybody is going around on camels. So they are managing these difficult animals. And usually, they will come up as this kind of intimidating factor. So it's like having cavalry. You know, or having a cavalry division, or having, you got more trucks and jeeps, you know, that sort of thing. I have over here this hymn. This is from the Church of England. It's an Anglican hymn, but like many of these Anglican hymns, they've sort of you start from seeing to see them pop up in like the Book of Christian Prayer, so the Liturgy of the Hours. If you say the Liturgy of the Hours, you'll recognize someone like John Nathan Neale. A lot of his songs end up as hymns in now the Catholic Liturgy of the Hours. And I'm familiar with this from, if you've ever read P.G. Woodhouse. P.G. Woodhouse is the one who came up with Bertie and Jeeves. You know, the gentleman who's always being rescued from disastrous marriages by his manservant, Jeeves. And Jeeves is the one who's just sort of this genius who keeps him out of trouble all the time. Well, Bertie Wooster, who's this totally hapless British aristocrat. These stories take place in the 1920s. You know, so this sort of lovely halcyon period between the two wars. And making a wastrel of himself, hanging out with the gentlemen and gentlemen's clubs and, playing cards, throwing cards into hats and things like that. But the one distinction that Bertie has is that when he was in, I guess, what would be the equivalent of middle school, he won a first in scripture knowledge. You know, this has been like the one distinction of his life. You know, he's been to Cambridge, a Cambridge graduate like all these gentlemen of this era, but the only intellectual distinction that he has is he had a first prescription knowledge when he was in grade school. And when he's pursued by people who inevitably he gets himself into all sorts of trouble with this and that, he's constantly reminded of this hymn. And this is how I first ran into it, right? This hymn that goes the following. Christian, do you see them on the holy ground? How the troops of Midian prowl and prowl around. And the hymn is called Christian, Do You See Them? So this episode with the Midianites, which occupies, a couple of chapters in Judges, these folks from Midian have a kind of a staying power that comes up in Christian hymnody. The other place, of course, is, and I can't remember if this is mentioned in the study or not, Isaiah 9. Did they mention Isaiah 9? So it's, no, so let me just get my... I didn't bring my book version. Let's see. So this is the thing that's usually read around Christmas time. Where do we go? Yeah, so start at... this is Isaiah. He's talking about the coming of the Messiah. Let's start at verse 4. The yoke of their burden, the rod of their shoulder, the scepter of their oppressor thou hast overcome, as in the day of Midian. For every violent taking of spoils with tumult, garment mingled with blood shall be burnt and be fuel for fire. For a child is born unto us, a son is given to us, and the government is upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, God the Mighty, Father of the World to Come, Prince of Peace. Okay, that all sounds familiar. But who were they using as a kind of an exemplar oppressor that figuratively the Messiah is defeating? The Midianites. So again, you might think of this as a kind of a small episode, but it's an episode that has some kind of staying power. Later on, in Isaiah 10:26, this is where we're told, yet a little while, a very little while, my indignation shall cease, my wrath shall be upon their wickedness, and the Lord of hosts shall raise up a scourge against them, according to the slaughter of Midian in the rock of Horeb, and there is rod over the sea, and he shall lift it up in the way of Egypt. Again, these are selected as kind of exemplar enemies of the chosen people. So sometimes the importance of a biblical figure is not so much the space they take up. You know, it can be something about the event itself. How much space does Melchizedek, take up? He occurs a couple of times, and yet in the long run, he turns out to be a very important person. Well, one of the more memorable things that happens in this episode of the defeat of the Midianites is the strategy that that God gives to Gideon, that he's going to take people away. And you're told at the beginning of chapter 7, I am doing this to make clear that it is my victory, that you do not rejoice in your own power, that it is through me that this has happened. So first, hey, anybody who's afraid, leave. Well, that gets rid of lots of people. That whittles it down. And then when you have this further cut, that when they drink, they're supposed to drink in ways that they're always looking up, that they're not just either face down in the water or looking at the water. And of course, when you look at commentary, Augustine talks this way, I think Jerome as well, that it's as if these are men who are not fully men. They drink like animals. Their eyes are on kind of the pleasures of the world, or the way their bodies can be satisfied, as opposed to being vigilant. Think of that language of St. Paul. Be sober, be vigilant, keep watch, right? Your enemy is prowling about. And there's something about the way that they're drinking, that they're always looking out. These are the kind of guys you want. Okay? And then, as has happened before, the victory is the defeat of the enemy is not something that takes place like the toppling of the idol. It doesn't take place in the daytime. It takes place at night. How's the strategy go again? You divide your army into thirds. You already have a small army and dividing them into thirds. That's textbook. That's a violation, by the way, of textbook strategy. You never divide your numbers in the face of a larger enemy. That was something that General Lee during the Civil War would break several times and get away with it. He would divide up his army in the face of superior numbers and win. More often than not, he was able to pull that off. Anyway, but they do it at night. They divide up into three, and this is why Karen brought her chauffeur last week. Chauffeur.
Yeah.
Chauffeur.
I am a chauffeur.
Chauffeur is the driver. Chauffeur is the driver. Yeah. So they've got the horn in there. They've got the horn in their right hand, their strong hand. Remember, this is the hand of strength and honor. They're blowing the horn, and then they got the torches in their other hand. And maybe when you read that episode, it throws the camp into a panic, and these people are running in there. They're even killing each other. And it drives essentially the Midians out. Maybe that look, there's something about that just maybe seems comical or improbable. Well, there's a commentary that Cornelius Lapide, this is one of these Latin commentaries, it's not available in English. Lapide gives seven different instances of battles in the ancient world that work just like this, where essentially they were able to sneak into the camp, raise a ruckus, and create a panic. If you've already got people who are a little edgy and You know, well, and you come in at night. Remember, night where you don't have electricity, you don't have any of those things. You hear these things about how people in the ancient world were. They were afraid of the dark, and they were afraid. They had superstitions about the dark. What the heck would we look like if the grid went down? You know, you ever see what major cities look like when there are power outages for long periods of time? You have reason to be frightened. That is a fear that we forget because we're surrounded by electricity. And when we don't have that, then we're back in the same position as anybody in, you know, ancient Greece or ancient Israel. In any event, they blow horns. I mean, you can picture it. They're blowing horns. They've got these torches. These people feel as though they've been completely surrounded. And so, yes, they panic. In Xenophon's Anabasis, to give you a counterexample, the Greek soldiers, they're mercenaries who were in the middle of what would be modern-day Iraq, they would do these little drills so their soldiers wouldn't panic. They would do things at night. I think they marched or they ran a donkey through the camp at night, and they put little lights on them or something like this, you know, torches on them. And people were tempted to panic, and they got control. And so, you know, as they would at night, as they were getting ready to guard, okay, are you guys going to panic because of the donkey? That would be their sort of shaming of them, right? If something happens in the night, don't panic. Keep order. Right? But they would have little drills to make that happen. So these people don't. They disperse. They panic. They end up killing at times each other. He wins. I should talk about the dream of this bread. It's very easy not to. I mean, I think a lot of times when we read this, you know, bread is bread. You know, and that it's barley bread. Remember, barley bread is what the poor folk eat. This is rough, hard, difficult to eat bread. Remember when the apostles, I think this is the 5,000. You know, how are we going to feed them? Well, all we got is like a couple of loaves of this barley bread, right? The cheapest bread possible. The other thing I'm reminded of in this connection, again, for us, bread is bread, but in my grandmother's time, like, poor people, they ate like black bread and brown bread. And the sign that you had money was that you could eat that white, puffy, purified stuff. Okay? And now it's exactly the opposite. That white, puffy, purified stuff is cheap as dirt. And if you want to buy like grainy, gritty, you know, bread, you're gonna organic artisan bread, you're gonna pay a pretty penny for it. So the scale is like completely reversed. You have to be able to look at this hard, tough, grainy bread and understand this is what the poor people ate. This is like the time of my grandmother. Okay? So so therefore the message is that these people are going to be defeated by something poor and contemptible. Something that doesn't look like much. And that makes it clear that it's God doing it. You know, that somehow they're going to be defeated by this rolling loaf of bread through the camp. But in a way, these Israelites are as poor and as humble as barley bread. And that's how God defeats them. Now, over time, of course, there's a change. At the beginning of 8, no longer is Gideon, as it were, being moved by God in certain ways. It's more of him taking it on himself. And you'll notice that the actions that he does, they tend to involve him personally more. So remember, he says, you know, that when he has that group of Midianites, I would have spared you, but you killed my relatives, you killed my brethren, right? Prepare to die, right? He's, you know, he's got to exact revenge on him. Now, that is something apart from whatever mission, you know, God has for him, okay? That's more of he's taken it onto himself. In fact, there's this very telling scene. Lillian Klein makes this point that... you remember, he wants this boy to sort of take revenge for him, because there's this humiliation in this in this young boy doing it for him. In other words, that these grown men would be killed by a boy, right? And he can't do it. He's not comfortable doing it. So he comes in and does the hacking, himself. And in a way, that boy is sort of like him, like he was earlier, right? Lacking in confidence, needing God to give him direction. And now he's got that confidence, but that confidence is kind of a mixed bag. On the one hand, he doesn't exploit it to the full. Remember, he's offered, the people want him to be king. And he refuses it. He says, God is to be your king. We're not going to be like these other people. I'm not going to be a king. I'm not going to have my sons after me to be a king. Okay? On the one hand, he retains that kind of humility. But on the other hand, he has taken a kind of a personal toughness, which you see in the way that he executes justice, not just on the Midianites, but also on these group of fellow Israelites who won't help him. I mean, at least with the Midianites, he says, I would spare you if... Whereas the Israelites don't even get that, right? Join the effort or else, help out or else. I wanted to come to this bit over here. Remember, we talked about how it is that the word spirit is used, and Othniel is described as having the spirit, Gideon is described, Jephthah, and then Samson is described as having the spirit several times. And I just showed this to you, and I didn't explain what does it mean to have the Spirit, and I wanted to have a little more time to think about that. One additional thing I have to say here is these various people are given the Spirit, but Gideon of all these people is the one who is clothed with the Spirit. The verb that's used is clothed. Okay. So, like the way that you talk about putting on Jesus Christ, the way that you talk about clothing yourself in justice and virtue, right? So you clothe yourself in the virtues. When years and years ago, when I was an altar boy in college, there was a vesting prayer that all of us altar boys said, we didn't just put on the get up and gossip or, their sports stories. The idea was you put this on and you recited Inue me dominum novum hominum creatum justitiam veritatem. I butcher it, but it's clothe me as a new man in justice and truth. And you recited this, so there was a vesting prayer you said when you put it on, there was a vesting prayer you said when you put it off. When you de-vested. And so the idea that you are putting on something that the Lord has given you, and that somehow Gideon merits that or characterizes that in ways that the other ones not as much. What does spirit mean? For us, when we look at spirit, of course, as Christians, our first sense of spirit is like the Holy Spirit. So we think of somebody being guided by, let's say, grace or wisdom, and we think of gifts of the Holy Spirit, piety, meekness, and so on. But when you look at spirit in this context, remember, we're talking about people who are waging war. So spiritedness in this context doesn't appear to be something that is first of all, a Christ-like virtue in the sense of meekness or humility or piety. It appears to be more spiritedness in the sense of energy or zeal or drive to carry out a certain task that's part of God's plan. So in Greek, sometimes when you see the word for spirit, it's pneuma. Like breath, like pneumonia, or things like that, right? You have problems breathing. So pneuma. So for us, it would look like P-N-E-U-M-A, pneuma. That's one word, it's spirit. Sometimes, usually not in Scripture. Scripture doesn't usually have the same word. although the idea seems to be here, thumos. And that's T-H-U-M-O-S. That's what it would look like in English. And thumos is spiritedness, but it's spiritedness in the sense of like drive or ambition or zeal or energy to do some kind of difficult task. That's the idea. You know, and it's often associated with pride, and it could be personal pride or pride in your country or family pride. That's the idea of thumos. And so that these people are described as having the spirit, it seems to be more like that thumos spirit, that they have a kind of drive and power against God's enemies. And that would, I'll have to say more about this when we get to Samson, that would help to make sense of at least some of the things that Samson does, that they don't seem, how to put it, they don't seem Christ-like, you know, in imitate or in character. But you're told, for example, this passage right here, 13:24-25, this is where he goes down to this Philistine village and sees a good-looking girl and comes back to his parents and says, you know, I want her. You know, how is this guy, if you're thinking of the Spirit as like the same thing that's animating John the Baptist or the apostles and so on, that's a little hard to figure out. But if you're thinking of the Spirit in the sense of he's been being given some kind of zeal or drive against God's enemies, well, falling in love with a girl was the trigger for that for him. You know, falling in love with a Philistine girl was the trigger. That's what got that started. So it's not spirit, you know, in the kind of put it in the sense that we're used to, I think, as Christians. Gideon is, as I said, he's clothed with this spirit that gives him this energy against his enemies. But you'll notice by the end of 8, he's clothing himself a little differently, right? He's clothing himself with gold, right? After having defeated these enemies, now you're hearing about him taking spoils. And if you think back to Exodus and Numbers, remember that was always a bad idea. So this, now, that doesn't end up corrupting him. That doesn't end up corrupting him. But it does, as you find out, corrupt the people after him. You have to think that one person this is making an impact on is Abimelech. That he sees the kind of power that his father has. But he doesn't have the kind of humility or personal self-control that his father has. So once his father is out of the picture, he wants to be king. He wants to have these things that his father had, but didn't seem to enjoy fully or take advantage of. Yeah, go ahead.
Like you said about the vowels.
Yeah.
In Hebrew, it would be Avi Melech, because the B and the V look
right.
Identical, but yep. It's the vowels that change it. So Avi means father, Melech is king.
King, yep.
So is that my father?
Father is king.
Is king. So he
don't you know who my daddy is?
Yeah.
Don't you know who? Yeah. 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 So that, and evidently the putting up of the ephod. Remember, ephod, first we think of as some kind of cloak or something, but it's clear it's not that in this context. That it's some kind of sacred thing that is put up as we're to honor this victory. Like the Romans. Or the Greeks, you won a battle. You put up a trophy. You put up this big marker that said that established your achievement. And so the ephod is meant to be this memorial to God for the victory, but for the people afterwards becomes a kind of monument unto itself. It's a very telling thing. I think of when I think of this episode, the fact that. Gideon is able to have certain things for himself which don't corrupt him so much as the people who come after him and the people around him. I'm reminded of some of these discussions that people had of the greatest generation, right? So people who grew up during the Great Depression or grew up during the war or were young people during the war themselves. One of the knocks on the greatest generation is these are the people who raise the most spoiled children imaginable. because they had lived through war, they had lived through depression, they had come into a period of prosperity, they had worked very hard and then were able to find a place for themselves during that period. But he said, I've seen several people who say, but the problem was they didn't want to impose any of that hardship on their kids. Their idea is my kids don't have to have any of that. They don't have to wonder where food is going to come from, or father's going to lose their job, or people are going to attack us or whatnot. And you look at this kind of lifestyle of the 50s, in a way, you were sort of raining prosperity down on young people. And these are young people who, not having had the sacrifices of their parents, not having had that, in a way, those parents could grow up with that prosperity. And it didn't corrupt, it didn't spoil them. Because they could always look at that prosperity and think, you know, this could be gone tomorrow. You know, this is, you know, people like my father who grew up during the Great Depression. I mean, he was a professor. He had tenure at the university, and he still had like his union card from when he worked as a longshoreman in the Bay Area. That somehow, like if it all fell apart, I could go back to the docks or something like that. I mean, people who grew up. My father remembered people coming to the back door, begging for egg sandwiches during the Depression. He remembers people coming. They didn't come to the front door. They came to the back door. They were ashamed. And, you know, you squirreled away money. You know, people of that generation who saved and saved and saved. Who knows when it was going to all, you know, sort of come apart. But if all you've ever known is, you know, prosperity and plenty and so on, that is tough not to, as it were, grow up with that and be spoiled. You know, so were the kids of the 60s and 70s, were they the most socially conscious? Or were they just flat out the most spoiled group of kids in the history of the world? And by the way, it's a thing that, you know, it's a thing for, you know, to what degree are you able to control your own beneficence to your own children? You know, when you enjoy in plenty, you want them to enjoy in plenty. But are there sacrifices and all sorts of things that got you to that point that allow you to enjoy the plenty without it spoiling you? What stops them from being spoiled? What stops them from being spoiled? You know, unless there were, and please don't tell me service trips. Please don't tell me I have to volunteer periodically. You know, unless there are things that really are sort of habits of self-restraint or habits of doing without, you know, there's no way you experience that. You know, there's no way you have that as a kind of inner experience. Go ahead.
So when it says that the 25 became a snare to Gideon, does that mean more that, or?
Yeah, I don't think it became a snare to him. I think it became a snare more to the people than it did to him.
Okay.
But I mean, we can look at that. We can look at that.
Yep.
Yeah, and I don't think that's the sense. Yeah, certainly, and I would want to look at different ways that might be phrased, because at least, I mean, yes, there is that, but it doesn't seem to describe what that looks like, or and clearly what happens is that it's a snare for the people who come after. Clearly, there's a kind of prosperity and achievement here that they sort of want to take on its own terms, apart from the fidelity to God that allowed Gideon to do these things. But that, I mean, I would say this, you could say this much. Even though he gives the honor to God, doesn't the taking of spoils, isn't there some act of self-aggrandizement there? Even when you say, I'm building this as a memorial to God, isn't there a way in which you're also reminding yourself? So put it this way, I would say that there is a connection between the way that it's described as a snare and certainly the way in which he is taking spoils in a way that he wasn't doing before, and which when you look back at Exodus and Numbers and so on, always is a bad idea. Always involves in some way taking something from God. Lillian Klein puts it this way. He no longer appears to be clothed with the Spirit. He's clothed with gold. That's the way that Lillian Klein puts it. Go ahead, Ms. Kroll.
I'm just getting that the Ten Commandments were given before, and thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife or, you know,
or goods,
adultery.
Or, yep.
And then the 70 children of Gideon and all of his wives. And how did they translate that particular commandment?
I'm not understanding your question.
Well, why was it okay for him to have so many wives and a concubine? And
They do not clearly have monogamous marriage at this point. Remember, you see it later with...
But didn't they know that that was part of the Ten Commandments, that they were given by Moses?
No, they don't appear to. I mean, yeah. Think of Solomon. David has at least 3 or 4 wives.
Yeah, so what...
I mean, I don't know that they're all... I don't know. I can think of 3 or 4 names, but I know there may be more. So they did not have the idea, they did not solidly have the idea of what we would call one man, one woman marriage.
Yeah.
They did not completely have that idea.
But
they weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Nope.
Yes, it was. Wherever powerful men can get access to more women, they will. And that is not ancient. That is human.
Poor men definitely.
Yeah, and by the way, I don't know that women want to have more than one man. The whole sexual dynamic is very different. Yeah. If you are a rich and powerful man, that you are able to have. Access to younger and beautiful women is not only enjoyable, it's a sort of a mark of your success. For women, the mark of success is that you are able to cover yourself in beautiful things. It's not having lots of men around. I mean, having them serve as background in tuxedos, as escorts, or so on, I mean, that can be nice. But that, you know, that Imelda Marcos had 1,000 shoes. That's the kind of thing which no man would aspire to. And lots of women could look at, well, 1,000, of course, that's too many. I mean, I would have no more than 500. No more than that. So it's the kind of thing you start to figure out when you're, I don't know, about 7 or 8 years old. You know, that opposite sex, they really are different. They really are different. Yeah, go ahead.
We were wondering in our group, is this something that they still use to this day in Jewish ceremonies?
No, it went down with the temple. Okay. This is what it actually looks like.
Yeah, although in the things that I was reading, and please feel free to disagree, ephod first means like sacred gear like that, or sacred clothes. But ephod will also be used in context that it's hard to picture it being clothes. It does sound more like a memorial or a trophy or something.
Inside of here was like a little pouch. And
okay.
There were two stones in there with all of the tribe's names written on two stones. The thing would come down, the priest would shake it, and this is where he got snared, because he created his own. This was commanded way back in Exodus.
Yep, yep.
Exodus 28:39, and it was commanded that this is what it should look like. So when Gideon was making these ephods, these kind of dice, if you will.
Oh, okay.
To figure out what the will of the Lord was. Instead of going to the priest and the tabernacle and God's thing, he created his own ephod.
Okay.
And some cultures, other cultures use the same things, and they might have been bigger, or they might have been different shapes or whatever.
Got it. Okay.
But him constructing his own ephod, he was violating.
Yeah. Okay.
He was
Got
only
it.
A judge. He's
Got
not.
It. Yeah, you're not supposed to.
Liked.
Right. He's not supposed to be made. In other words, you're not supposed to be making things that are religious memorials if you're like the civil authority.
Right.
He's essentially a civil authority. He's still commanded by God, but he's commanded by God to carry out what we would consider secular things. He's not supposed to establish something that's memorial. That's religious, that's something distinctively religious. It's like what you saw in Joshua. Remember the which tribe that is they try to create their own altar as opposed to what's over in where is it again? Gilgal or Shechem?
Shechem.
Yeah. Yeah, Kim. This is a kind of a small neighborhood, so you keep running into the same spots over and over again. Well, very good. You have your questions for up here for next time, and we'll continue with Jephthah.